welcome to our next session. And this session will be presented by four presenters. This is Alexander Gu, Joan Kelly, Hyun Yu, and Leslie Tang. And the title of their presentation is Giving It Back from Oral Folktales to Illustrated Bilingual Video Books from So, welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. I'll start by acknowledging our funding body, the Singapore Ministry of Education, and I'd also particularly like to thank our two narrators, Mr. Rongsen Limba Jamir and Mr. Kikam Sungba Inchen of Mangutung Village, Mugokchung District, Nagaland. And I'll introduce my team, the artist facilitator, Joan Kelly, sitting to my right here, and our artists, Leslie Tang and Bei Yang Yu. Okay, so I'll start with an overview of the project. It's a collaborative project between artists and linguists, and it involved taking some texts that I recorded back in the 90s and modifying the prose so that they would be suitable for children's reading books. Of course, we had to develop a practical orthography to go along with this, and then we handed over to the artist collaborators, and they developed the illustrations to accompany the folktales. Then we took the texts, the mock-up books, to Nagaland, and we tested them on native speakers to see how good the orthography was. And finally, we've been negotiating with the Owl community to have them accepted, and that's an ongoing process. So the motivation was that I made a career out of linguistics based on the work that I'd done on this language, and I thought it would be good to return the output of academic research to the community. And we thought that traditional folk tales would be the best way of doing this because they're culturally significant to the community, and also they can serve as a vehicle to introduce literacy at an early age. We also thought it would be a nice way of maintaining pride in an indigenous culture in this age of globalization. And these are stories that are transmitted orally, so writing them helps to preserve these kinds of traditions. A little bit about the Owl language. It's spoken at extreme northeast India. You'll see a red dot there on the map of India. And state of Nagaland in red is Mogokchung district. There is two major dialects, Chungli and Mongsen. Total number of Owl speakers is about 232,000, probably a bit more now. Chungli is the prestige dialect because it's got a writing system, and Mongsen's an unspoken language, probably spoken by about 40% of the community, I would say. Why should we develop another orthography if Chungli has already got one? Well, we can think of five good reasons. First one is that the phonology of Chungli is quite different to the phonology of Owl, Mongsen Owl. It has voice onset time contrasts. I should say Mongsen Owl's got voice onset time contrasts in the plosive and affricate series, and Chungli doesn't. It's also a pre-phoneme orthography. It was developed in the 1870s, and there are lots of problems with it. There are a number of many-to-one relationships between symbols and phonemes. It doesn't mark tone either. And I think that as an unwritten dialect, Mongsen is potentially more endangered because if it's not written, it's probably not going to last as long in the future. And it's also somewhat unfair to Mongsen speakers who first have to learn Chungli in order to study up to the 10th grade. So if they could learn in their own languages, or their own language, their own dialect, then that would be a good thing. A little bit about the phonology. It's not standardized, so you find that every single village has got its own particular way of speaking. I mentioned before, there's a two-way voice onset time contrast in stops and affricates. There are there is in some varieties a voiceless sonorant series that adds seven phonemes to the consonant inventory. Simple vowel systems, usually five or six vowels only, three tones, plus intonation patterns that get overlaid over the tops of the tones. Here's a chart showing the consonant phoneme inventory. The symbols in brackets are the voiceless sonorant series. here are the vowels. Sorry, I'm going to go quite fast because there's so many of us to talk. Quite simple triangular system. The high-back rounded vowel has got two allophones, which are useful to us for the orthography. There's creaky voice just on the low central vowel with a very low functional node. Here's a proposed orthography. Notice that I've left out the voiceless sonorants. That'll just make it harder for readers. They tend to merge them in a lot of villages anyway. Some of the issues. I'm trying to make it fairly close to English and also to the Chumley orthography, so it's recognisable to them and intuitive. I'm avoiding using voiced, stopped and affricate symbols because I want to reinforce the understanding that there is no voice, stop or affricate in this language. And I wanted to contrast it with English. The books are bilingual, of course, as well. They're written in Mocenaeal as well as English. I use C initially to represent the voiceless unaspirated palato-alveolar affricate. That was problematic. I had to change that for J after testing. There's a glottal stop and a glottal approximant. I'm using the same symbol H. The glottal stop only occurs word finally, so it doesn't create any ambiguity. Here's a proposed orthography for the vowels. I'm using O for the back, high back rounded vowel. That allows me to use the umlauted U for the schwa. Nagas have got a love affair with this symbol. They think it represents their language and distinguishes it from others. So I have to use it even though it creates problems for using diacritics. I'm not worrying about marking the creaky voice because it carries such a low functional load. And I'm using acute, nothing, and grey for marking high, mid, and low tones, respectively. So, I just mentioned all this, so I can just skip over this. Just talk about marking tones. Should I mark tone or not? Well, I think it's going to be useful to decrease ambiguity due to homophony, and it'll also increase reading speed as well. Kids won't have to read ahead and then come back and work out how to pronounce all the homophones. Accents are easily typed. When you're texting, you can just hold down a key on a smartphone and choose the right accent. I'm hoping that this script will help to standardize the language. It'll help to standardize spellings. There are a few issues with using a new script, introducing one into the community. There might be some resistance from the Chumley community. They might see this as a threat to their hegemony. It could even split the community, I suppose, along this dialect cleavage between Chumley and Mocsen. These languages they're mutually unintelligible. It takes some Chumley speakers can't understand Mocsen speakers. Mocsen speakers, they end up learning Chumley because they go to church. They use that in the church. The Bible's translated into that language, and it's also the language used up to the 10th grade. Also, when we presented the books to the chairman of the Our Literature Board, he was less than encouraging. He's worried about a backlash from the community through introducing a new script. I realise this is a problem. However, of course, if we don't write this language, then the chances of it becoming endangered in the future is greatly increased. All of these languages of Nagaland are recognised as being vulnerable by UNESCO, so this is an issue. There's a bit of a dilemma. What's our responsibility ethical responsibility as linguists? We need to document these languages, but we don't want to create disharmony in the community by doing it. Maybe that's something that we can talk about in the question time. But now I'm going to pass over to my colleague Joan Kelly, and she's going to talk about taking the narratives and converting them into illustrated books.
Hi, so I'm an artist and I'm also at NTU with Alec. I work as a facilitator, but also try to help us to visualize what it's like to be in Nagaland and what it's like to read a text for the first time while we're doing our illustrated books. The illustrators are our students at ADM, but I want to tell you that as you see their work, you'll see that they're artists in their own right. Linguists usually use text to document their work. And so I want to talk a little bit about the differences and what drawing can bring to that. Now, Text has a privileged status over drawing. It's in scholarly work, it's seen as unscientific and subjective. But what is unique to drawing, that drawing can give? Now, with speech and sound, there might be no relation at all to the word that's produced, where drawing may have a direct resemblance to what it signifies. Drawing renders thought visible. Lines, as we all perceive in the observable world, do not actually exist. Lines are a representation and a convention. Lines are organized into coded systems to approximate spatial ideas and concepts and descriptive accents. And gestural lines carry with them the imprints of the body that make them. So drawing's very unique in this way, where it's actually the only autobiographical signifier. The mark that you make, the mark I make with my hand is actually, it's unique to anything. Actions are carried out in time with drawing. Drawing records history. If I'm doing a portrait, the portrait that I create is not only a representation of that person, but it's a recording of the time and the history that we, the time that we took to make it through the mark. Now I'm going to show you two drawings by Michelangelo that you might recognize, but the reason I'm showing you them is that they're made of the same subject matter, the male nude, but they're drawn in completely different ways as to try to communicate different concepts, whereas the drawing on your left, is a representation of the human form, but it's talking about the concept of transcendence from the physical to the spiritual. And you can see the different types of mark and the different handling, the methods that he used to draw this quite differently than the drawing on the other side, which is high contrast, exaggeration of form, and communicating ideas of a celebration of the power of the human body. So I'm trying to express how method and production of the drawing is integrated into the content of the drawing, so that when you when I'm in the field and I'm working in the workshops I'm doing, that are quite in their infant stage, to try to gather visual iconography from the community, there's quite a range of information that I can get besides just subject matter from the actual way that the drawings are created. Now I'm going to hand it over to Leslie Tang, who's one of our illustrators.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Leslie. I'm going to be presenting a little bit about my story that I illustrated. The folktale that I chose is called The Tiger and the Rabbit. It's got this traditional structure that's very similar to Aesop's fables, as many of you would know. The moral of this story is that a proud king can come to grief in front of a meek individual. So what this story is about, just to give you a short summary, is that a tiger, as the king of the forest, orders an animal to come to him each day to be eaten. And the rabbit, who does not wish to die, she comes up with a plan using her intellect to outwit the tiger and trick him into drowning himself so that she escapes death. So this illustrates the moral of this fable, this folktale. So my visual development for this story, it started off as being something quite realistic. I chose to do my work digitally because this project involves a lot of reworking for compositions, and I wanted to ensure that when we place the text on the spread of the book, it's able to be placed alongside the images without either one conflicting with each other. So I chose to do it digitally. It helps a lot when you want to rework all the different formats. Say, for example, if I wanted to place the text right there, I could move the bird away and it would give me enough space to place the text that I needed. But then when I did further visual research, I came across the Wayang Kulit, the shadow puppets of Indonesia. Shadow puppets are often used to tell stories, especially with a folktale feel. It's a very rich form of visual storytelling, and I find it personally to be very beautiful, the play of light versus shadow. And this decision to do my work in this way, in this kind of silhouette style, it turned out to be quite prudent. I'll go into that in a little bit. But this formed the basis of most of my visual inspiration. So, based on the Why I'm Clueless, I decided to do my characters, the rabbit and the tiger, in silhouettes and use decorative elements to distinguish them from one another. The decorative elements helped make the characters more recognizable to children. And while I used silhouettes, it made the space of the book, the spreads, more two-dimensional as opposed to the three-dimensional environment that I tried to go with earlier on. So for the Why I'm Clueless, I felt that it was a very prudent decision in terms of a design perspective, because the story does involve the tiger eating a lot of the other animals, and I felt that if I were to depict this in a realistic fashion, it might be too disturbing for children. So I thought that by using the open mouth of the tiger and the diminishing animals as they approach the tiger, it would convey that sense of fear without the blatant sense of horror that the images would provoke. So this was how I got around the problem of depicting content that could be disturbing when the audience is mostly children. So this was how the style helped me to work around that problem. For the page design, since the environment is forested, I used decorative borders that show the vegetation in the forest. It helps to integrate the drawings on one side of the page with the text on the other side of the page because of how the borders move across both pages to link the whole spread together as a composition. This was an important concern for me because I didn't want to just place the text on one side and the image on the other side. It would look pretty disjointed, and I wanted the design and the text to flow together. Another concern from a design perspective was the selection of the typeface. Because the Mong San Ao dialect uses diacritics, I needed to choose a typeface that went well with the design of the spreads, but also portrayed diacritics accurately. The decorative typefaces that I selected did not have diacritics, so in the end I went with Georgia to show the diacritics properly in the text. So this was another consideration that I encountered in my project, besides depicting the environment and the characters in a style that would be good for the audience. So the key point that I had from my story was that the adaptation of different visual storytelling formats across different cultures can work well as an interesting visual tool, and it's always important to keep the target audience in mind when you're deciding how to illustrate the environment and the characters. The page borders and the typeface selection were also pretty important as well. And I'm open to work on future projects that are similar to these, so if anyone would like to contact me, my details are on the slide. Now I'm going to pass the time to Yang Yu, who will talk about the story that she did.
Hi everyone, I'm Pei Yang Yu, and the story that I'm doing is called Why Does a Leopard Cat Eat Chickens? So here are some thumbnails of my completed storybook. It's actually a story about why the leopard cat eat chickens after finding out that they are actually quite harmless. And the leopard cat uses her saliva to trick the hawk into showing his weakness, so that you use his weakness to the leopard cat's advantage. So I use a really rather realistic style in depicting the paintings, and it's rather colorful as you can see, because I feel that children can resonate better with realistic images. And it's also an interactive 3D pop-up book where viewers and users can interact with the book by pulling the tabs as seen in this page, where you can pull the yellow tab and the cock can dance. And as for this, the opening and the closing of the book can cause the cock to open and close its mouth. And for this page, users can push the leopard cat over as a way of like, pouncing on the cock. So the artist that I referenced was Winslow Homer and Georgia Innes. Winslow Homer's green painting uses different shades of green to depict the feeling of landscape, while Georgia Innes uses dynamic composition to evoke the atmospheric emotions. So I decided to use similar technique for my illustrated books. Seen from this slide, The first cycle of the day is showing my series of illustrations through the different shades of green used. For instance, in the depiction of dawn, I mainly use blue-green, green-green for morning, yellow-green for noon, and a mixture of green for sunset. The complete cycle of the day is looking on the vulnerability of mankind on Earth as reflected on Netherlands folktale and past traditions. So this project collaboration has indeed introduced me to Nagales tradition and culture, and actually previously I was very new to Nagaland. I even make a mistake with the depiction of the cock as seen on this slide. As I view this from a city girl's point of view, I depicted a hand as a cock. Yeah, it was only after a consult of my professors that I realized the mistake is so important that I had to change it. And the end result was to change it to Nagaland's indigenous type called the Red Jungle Fowl. So through this mistake, I learned that I need to view the books through others' lenses, such that the illustrations can be acceptable and relatable to the people in Nagaland, since these books are for them. And it's also very important for me as an artist to not overlook the details that can affect the interpretation of Nagaland's culture and tradition. So, before I end off my presentation, I wanted to share the experiences of Singapore students who had seen my work, their experiences. So, as my mom is teaching children Chinese tuition from primary to secondary school, she decided to use my book as one of her teaching resources, although the book is not in Chinese. So, I actually joined in one of the sessions, and from her comments, the students were very captivated by the strong imagery and interactive pop-ups. However, most of the students actually looked at the story at a rather surface level. They thought that the story is simply just about the foolishness of the cock being eaten up by the leopard cat. But actually, there's definitely more significance to this story. So it was only after some explanation of Nagaland's culture and tradition that they managed to see the story in a different light. So from here, my mom's initiation made me realize that language transcends all boundaries. And some of the students even try to pronounce the all language just for the fun of it. Yeah, and through this, I feel that the publication of the storybook will help to preserve the language and tradition of Nagaland, and it can be quite successful when it's being disseminated across all communities. And I feel that the visual and the oral impact of the book will eventually reach out to the hearts of the people. So it will be my pleasure to further work with other interested linguists to create more illustrated storybook. And I feel that this will be very well in doing my part in contributing towards language conservation. And in conclusion, our collaboration with linguists can produce materials of lasting value to minority communities. And the bilingual storybooks will introduce and develop literary skills in two languages that will help to enhance learning among the young children. And working in folklore will help to maintain oral cultural traditions. Yeah, so that's the end of our presentation. And we have a copy of our book here. So if you wish to view it, I'll just pass it around and you can take a look at it. Thank you.
Were very inspiring, yeah. So we have like 7 minutes for questions and comments. Anyone? Let's start down there. Yeah.
Thanks. It was really interesting. It was obviously a lot of work on this. I'm interested in a point like Alec about the fact that the chairman of the literature board wasn't interested in an orthography, and I'm sort of interested in.
Thanks for the question, Barb. Yeah, this is a big issue, right? Because I'll point out to begin with that the chair of our literature board is a Mong Sen speaker, but it's dominated by Tungni speakers. So maybe that is important in his, for understanding his initial reluctance. I'm also not sure just how widely he distributed these books. I'm working with Thimson Ngsang, who's a native speaker of Mong Sen, and I've been working with him on this. Some members of the community, of course all the people we've shown these books to are just astonished. They've never read anything in their own language before. So they're really blown away by this. So I don't think that the chairman of the Our Literature Board's response is representative of the community. That's why I can't go ahead and publish this without their consent, right? That would be causing potentially problems. But I'm going to have to do some politicking, I think, and Thimsa Ngsang, my collaborator, linguist, who is from Nagaland, he's also going to do some politicking as well to see if we can get the community to accept the introduction of another script into their community. But I don't know what the outcome of this is going to be at this stage. We're aware of the issues and the potential problems that it could cause if it's seen as being divisive. Yeah. If anybody has had experience of introducing a script for a minor dialect, I'd be very interested to talk to you about your experiences and how you resolve problems.
When you say script, are you implying that the other ones are an Indic script?
Is
this Roman?
No, they're both in Roman script. There's been a strong tradition of Christian proselytization in Nagaland for the last 100 plus years. The people of Nagaland, for a long time and still now, have been fighting for independence from India. They don't want to be part of India. Having a Roman script, being Christian, is different ways that they can distinguish themselves from the people of the plains. So the actual choice of a Roman script isn't an issue. It's introducing a new script for a minor dialect that's potentially an issue.
How many stories, I love the project, I will be contacting because I also worked in Nago and you know this, but how many books do you think are you planning to produce? What sort of age ranges are you thinking of? I'm looking at some of the stories and just looking at the gorgeous art, but the text is, there's a lot of text in many of these pages, and if it's at really early literacy, at a really early age, I'm wondering, are you also planning to produce books which are simpler in not just, in content?
Yeah, this is like a pilot project. This is the first time we've done this. These are the first two books that we worked on with artists, and they just seem conducive to, producing illustrations. We would probably need primers as well, which are at a much more basic level, and that would be something that we'd be happy to do as well. This could be illustrated. At the moment, there's really, there's religious material, but there's the Bible, but at least in Chungni, but there's not a great deal of Chungni literature. Of course, there's no literature at all for Mong Sen because it's not written up to now. But we would, keep working on this. So I imagine if I can keep working with the artists, we'll keep producing stuff and we'll do it for a whole range of ages, as well as for adults, because the adults, their response to this has been fantastic as well. Watching them trying to read it, really exciting to see that. Yeah.
I think it's first there.
I was wondering, Alex, if there were any younger speakers of either Chungni or Mong Sen text in the languages?
It seems to me that they text in English or Nagamese, but that's something that maybe they would start texting in their own language if they had a standardized orthography to do it.
Yeah,
but it's certainly in English or Nagamese at the moment.
Question for the artists. Question is, as you look forward to working with other projects, what sort of reusable components do you imagine that might be in your books as visual elements that might be used in other stories or similar stories in other languages? How would you approach managing that?
Do you want to
Could we
get a clarification on what you mean by reusable components?
So maybe the picture of a bird. It could be generic, or it could be particular to a single story, a single publication. And if you start looking at doing multiple books, maybe even the same language or in a variety of closely related languages, then it might have that same character, that same bird, right, to be able to be used in a variety of books and publications. How would you manage that?
Well, it's possible that we could reuse the same graphics, especially in my case, since I work digitally. But I would probably come up with different characters for different stories, especially if they're from different communities, because I don't think that it would be productive to reuse the same graphics all across different communities, mostly because each story is unique, and I just personally would not do that as part of my process. I would work with each one individually.
As for mine, because my style is really different from hers, I did all the paintings individually according to scenes. So probably I will change it accordingly to the different culture, the colors used, the background and everything, I will have to change it. Yeah, so probably there wouldn't be any reusable elements for my case.
I just wanted to say that it's not really a concept artists think of as a priority to reuse imagery from one project to the next or one concept to the next. We'd much prefer to develop the project from the beginning.
So thank you very much. Time is so important.